Thank you so much, Stan, for joining Living Black Radio. It's lovely to talk to you.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. And so I wanted to, first of all, talk to you about the focus of the point and how the name came about and the birth of the program.
Yeah, how did the name come about? We were sitting around talking about, you know, we didn't want to do something that just said, you know, NITV News or, you know, shows need to have some sort of edge now, and there needs to be something different about them. And we were tossing around names, and I said, you know, what if we had something where we just said that this is the point. The point of this is X. You know, we're doing this because we're making a point. And that's really where it came out of. That's the point. This is the point of this. That's why we do this. And it really sort of grew from there. And the program sort of evolved over the year. It's now got a good mix of live interviews, and we have a lot of, you know, focus on social engagement, social media. We have a news component. We have feature stories as well. We pack a lot into half an hour, and we try to deal with the whole range of issues, really. You know, obviously there's a political element to it each night, but we also try to look at people's individual lives, community life, whatever people are dealing with in their lives, really, whatever people are involved in, from sport to entertainment to politics and everything else. So we try to sort of cast the net fairly widely and be representative as much as we can of different parts of the country as well.
We've seen a shift in the visibility and the level of excellence of First Nations news and current affairs in Australia. I mean, it hasn't always been like that with the culture of mainstream media. Would you say that the development of NITV programming and the origins of NITV News really lifted the profile of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander content in the news and current affairs landscape?
Yeah, it's given it a distinctive flavour. Indigenous issues have always been covered to some degree, but it was always fairly sporadic and usually based around conflict and crisis. And that was the only time that commercial news would come to it, and the ABC would do stories, but the perspective was always as an outsider's perspective and not understanding who we are and how we think as a people and what our communities are and how do we represent those communities and who are the voices that we need to hear from. And so, you know, the mainstream media, for want of a better word, you know, doesn't really have that level of expertise and cultural awareness and sensitivity. And I think that's what NITV News has brought, or NITV in general has brought to the media landscape, is that this is our stories told our way, with an emphasis on really understanding these issues as it impacts from us and giving our people a voice. I think what we've done is now couple that with the professional excellence that's expected. You know, one of the things that I was very big on when I came to work at NITV was that saying, look, you know, I've made a career working all around the world alongside all other journalists and being judged on my merit. And I said to them when I came there, you know, I said, look, first of all, this has to be good journalism and it has to be good television. That's the first thing. You want people to watch, you want people to engage, you have to be engaging, you have to have good storytelling, you have to be professional, and you know, there are certain expectations that people have, and for as wide an audience as possible, we need to do that. And I think we've now married that professional expectation and excellence with the knowledge that we have, and we're starting to see those things really come together now, and it's creating a unique approach to these stories and broadening the audience as well.
Would you support more cross-cultural awareness and protocol education in universities for journalists and also out in the workplace and media outlets? I mean, there are issues that a lot of journalists are facing when it comes to representing or covering Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander content. Could you support that, or would you support that awareness and that education?
You know, I really get, philosophically, yes, I would support it, but I really get very tired of having to educate these people all the time about us, you know, and how to approach us. I just find, how many times do they need to be told about cultural sensitivities and understanding the people that you're reporting on? And it just never seems to change. I think it comes from a lack of respect, fundamentally, media practitioners towards us. You know, I've reported from more than 70 countries. I've lived in 5 different countries. You know, I've lived right throughout Asia, the Middle East, Europe, Africa, and wherever I would report, if I was going into China or Afghanistan or Pakistan or Iraq or Israel or whoever I was, I would first of all understand who I was talking about. And I would go in there with an awareness as much as I could about the sensitivities and the history. And I would not seek to impose myself, but to actually allow people to speak to me and tell their stories through me. I would learn language. How many, you know, Australian journalists would bother to even learn how to say hello in the language that they're going, the people they're going to report on? Now, I don't know if that takes cultural awareness training. That's just basic good manners. That's basic respect. And it is fundamental journalism. If you want to do the best job, then you need to understand the subject that you're reporting on. And, you know, that so often fails here. They just don't have a fundamental understanding or enough respect for us to gain that understanding to do their jobs more effectively.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the first things I was taught when I was working with elders, was it was about basic common sense and manners, and that was where the respect came from. So, I mean, that was one of my first learnings.
Yeah, it's just etiquette. It's just understanding the people. But like I say, I mean, that's fundamental journalism. That's journalism 101. If I was going into a Chinese village, you know, in remote China, and I couldn't even go in and say hello, or couldn't even have a basic conversation, or understand the history of that area and what has shaped those people, the history of conflict, of war, of revolution, the history of the impact of the Communist Party. That if I didn't understand those things, how on earth would I do my job? And yet we have journalists, non-Indigenous journalists, turning up in our community, unable to even say so much as hello, knowing nothing about the history of the area or the people or what shaped those people, and then reporting on us. It's just bad journalism apart from anything else.
I've seen it myself, Stan. I've seen camera operators just rock up where there's like a full circle of people with a smoking ceremony and just, you know, set up camera in the middle and point and shoot without even going and talking to anyone first. So
I know. It's just not acceptable. And I don't know. I mean, you know, we can give them all the cultural awareness training they like. If they don't have decent manners and respect, and if they're not good at their jobs, then, you know, we're not going to get very far.
You're listening to SBS Radio Living Black. I'm Kirsten Lindsay, and I'm speaking with Stan Grant, host of NITV's The Point. Stan is also a presenter for Sky News and columnist for The Guardian. Well, what was the turning point for you when you made the decision to follow the path as a journalist?
Look, it's hard to say. You know, I never really had a plan as such that I wanted to pursue. I didn't have a great education growing up. You know, my family were really very poor and itinerant and effectively homeless for the first 12 or 13 years of my life. And we moved from town to town, and I would start and finish schools, you know, every few weeks or every few months. I changed school more than 14, 15 times before I was even out of my teens. So I had a really sporadic and a very sort of limited education up until that point. I loved words and I loved stories and I loved books and I loved reading. So that was a strong thing that stayed with me. Those foundations always stayed with me. And as I got into high school and had a little bit more stability in my life, particularly for the last, say, 3 years of my high school, I was able to pursue that and follow that. And I wanted to get into journalism. I got into university and I studied at university. And through that, getting in touch with different people and different people supporting me and encouraging me, some doors opened up and I found myself in journalism. And I started with the Canberra Times, a coffee boy really, cleaning and fetching coffee and dinner for all the other journos and learning about the craft, and then going into radio, commercial radio with the Macquarie Radio Network, and then into ABC Television as a political correspondent. And then my career sort of really blossomed from there. But I just found that I was good at it, you know, apart from anything else. It was something I was just fundamentally very good at. I got it. I got what journalism was about. I dealt with the stress and the expectations and the anxiety. I never found that overwhelming, and it can be a very stressful career. I just found that it worked for me. It really opened up. And then I suppose once I left Australia, first of all with the Seven Network when I went to London, and then after that joining CNN and spending, you know, the next 12 years reporting all over the world for them, that was the great blossoming, I think, for me. That was the major sort of turning point in my career when I really felt I was at the height of my game.
Would you say that your spirituality and culture helps you and supports you to be able to do this job, because, you know, you are learning a lot about what's happening in the world, and it's not easy. Do you think that your culture and spirit helps keep you safe?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I really feel that growing up the way that I did and with our history and understanding what shaped us allowed me to have an empathy. And empathy is the most important thing you can have in journalism, I think. You know, if you have the ability to see the world through someone else's eyes, to approach that with dignity and respect, I think, you know, you'll go a long way as a journalist. And I had that because that was my upbringing. That was my history. And so whether I was reporting in China or North Korea or Afghanistan or Pakistan or wherever I was, I felt that I understood those people and those situations. I liked stories that came from those parts of the world. I liked stories of hardship. I like stories where people's lives are being shaped by big forces of history. And I felt that in a way I was expressing my own history through those stories and expressing myself through those stories. The other thing is that we're great storytellers, and I think that really helped me. We have an innate ability to weave a story and to be able to connect through stories. And I think, you know, that was very much a part of my upbringing, and that was a fundamental building block of my journalism. And I think the other thing is, you know, I come from a very big and very strong Aboriginal family, and that gave me a sense of confidence to engage with the world without feeling as if I was going to be diminished by it. I love being part of other cultures. You know, I loved learning to speak Chinese and Arabic and French. I loved mixing with other people from different countries. I love learning about other religions, and I felt that that was broadening me as a person. You know, I don't have this idea that, you know, we only have one way of doing things, or we cling to these cultural things to the exclusion of everything else. I think that if you're strong in your understanding of who you are and your cultural base, then you can incorporate other things as well and engage with other people, which really has enriched my life anyway.
Stan, you've shown that you're not afraid to show Australia and the rest of the world how you feel. And recently, when you were holding a public lecture at the University of New South Wales, you showed how deeply hurt you were by the crisis and treatment of children in juvenile detention after watching that Four Corners report. And I wanted to ask you, do you think we're going to see a change in the operational procedures of First Nations youth caught up in the criminal justice system with the opening of the Royal Commission in the Northern Territory and parliamentary inquiry in Queensland?
I would like to think so, but we've been at this point so many other times in our history. When I express those things, it feels very natural to me. You know, this is who I am. To stand up on a stage and to give a speech without being honest and open about the impact that has on us and has on me would just be fraudulent, really. So I feel I need to reflect how I feel about these things. And I would like to think that things will get different. I mean, things are better now for me than they were for my father, for instance. And I'm sure that in his life, things were a bit better than it was for his father or his grandfather. So there was incremental change, but we're constantly reminded of how steep the climb is for us when we see things like that. In 2016, we can still see people, young kids, being treated that way. Any kids. The fact is, though, they happen to be overwhelmingly our kids, Indigenous kids. It's hard to have faith when you see that these things continue despite all of the inquiries, despite former Royal Commissions that we've had, despite money that is spent and the goodwill of people, that we still find these entrenched pockets of brutality and discrimination. It's hard to be optimistic, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, you feel it when it's happened in your own family and then you're seeing it still happen to other young girls and boys. You know, it's that sort of intergenerational trauma and feeling that comes through when you're seeing it still happening.
It is, and you know, that's what I felt when I saw those boys. You know, I was watching that with my son, and he had an amazing life. You know, my son, compared to my life, lived all over the world. He's been to the best schools. My boys have had great opportunities in life. But he was watching that, and I could see him struggling to make sense of that, and his life and their lives and Australia and all of those things became very, very difficult for him at that moment to process. And I suppose when I was watching that, I was reliving and being reminded of what my father, his father and my, and, you know, have been through before. The history of brutality and incarceration in our family. We've all lived with that. We've all seen that. And when we see things like what, you know, happened to Don Dale, it just brings all of those memories back to the surface. It reopens those old wounds.
We've got five First Nations politicians in the 45th Parliament now. Can you see that there's going to be a change with more Indigenous-led consultation when it comes to policy that directly affects Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people?
Well, having people there, the calibre of the people that we have there, means that, you know, they'll be able to bring their voices to the debate, and they'll have an important voice in that debate. These are the people who are going to be sitting around the cabinet table, potentially, with the people who make our laws for our government. So to be on the inside with a voice and a level of influence is critical. We can't just do this as the voice of protest. We need to be able to get in the inside and make a difference. And I think having more Indigenous people in the Parliament will be able to do that. But I'm also mindful that, you know, our politics at the moment is not in a good state. Our parliamentary democracy is not in a good state.
Yeah.
There is no appetite for reform. There's no political courage. There's no great political leadership. And there is this heavy hand of the orthodoxy of the political party that often constrain the voices of the individual. And I think the challenge is going to be for any politician, but particularly Indigenous politicians, is how to speak with that authority and authenticity and honesty in a system where those things are not necessarily valued. In fact, in a party system where those things are often suppressed. And that is an enormous, enormous challenge.
Well, speaking of challenges, you've shown support for both the treaty and constitutional recognition. How do you think that both can happen effectively and be inclusive of all of our communities when our first law is seen by many people to take precedence to the Constitution? How can we get this right?
Well, the reality is we live in this modern state of Australia. That's where we live. And the Constitution of Australia affects us. The ability of the Parliament to make laws for us affects our lives. The intervention in the Northern Territory grew directly out of the ability, as it stands now in our Constitution, for our federal Parliament to make laws for Aboriginal people. So how do we reclaim some ability to be empowered in that situation? When we're not even properly acknowledged in the Constitution, this isn't just about nice words and symbolism. This is actually about the business of governing. The Constitution is a rule book. It sets out the rules for governance in Australia. We live in Australia and we are directly affected by our Constitution and the federal Parliament's ability to make laws for us. So straight away, we're in a power imbalance as a minority, an extreme minority, impoverished, often dispossessed and disadvantaged and disenfranchised. And we need to be able to reclaim some voice in that process. I think when you look at treaty as well, you know, what is a treaty? A treaty is just an agreement. We use this word treaty, but there are many treaties that exist in Australia right now. They're just not called treaties. There are land rights agreements. There are native title agreements. There are mining royalty agreements, there are land use agreements, water management agreements. There are all sorts of agreements that individual and communities are having with government, corporations, all across the country. And when we're starting to talk about things like treaty, starting to talk about things like recognition, what we are really talking about is empowering our ability to have a greater voice and greater clarity and greater recognition of our fundamental rights in a constitutional Western liberal democracy. The two things are not inconsistent. The two things are part of the overall ability to speak with some authority and power in this democracy. You know, if we look at the way Australian democracy works, we have layers of sovereignty. We have the federal government, the state government, local governments. Their roles are clearly defined. They make particular laws for their own constituency, and we live within that. be able to bring our voice with some clarity and some power to be able to influence the outcomes that are laws that are directly going to affect us.
You're listening to SBS Radio Living Black. I'm Kirsten Lindsay and I'm speaking with Stan Grant, host of NITV's The Point. Stan is also a presenter for Sky News and columnist for The Guardian. But what about the argument, and you would have heard it, I've heard it, where people are saying that the federal government does not, and the Commonwealth does not have the jurisdiction in the first place? I mean, how do we work with that?
Well, it's a lived reality. We can say that, but you and I pay our taxes. You and I drive on our roads. You and I send our kids to our school. When we get educated, we go to those universities. When we pay our taxes, we are also buying into a political system that directly impacts on our lives. I mean, we could have an academic argument about whether or not, you know, this is legitimate, and there are real questions about the legitimacy of the Australian settlement. The British coming, extinguishing the rights of Indigenous people, without recognition of those rights, without formal treaties that happen in other parts of the world. This is the unfinished business of settlement. But we are now negotiating that unfinished business of settlement in the lived reality of Australia in the 21st century as a political entity, as a state, and our place within that state. So we can't separate those two things. That is the reality of our lives.
It's a very tricky one to facilitate, isn't it?
Yeah, but, you know, this is actually not unusual. You know, we look at these things as if this is somehow unique to us. You know, this is the history of the world. You know, two great forces of our world in the 21st century are globalization, the evening out of and coming together of different peoples around the world. The world is much smaller. So globalization is a huge factor, and post-colonization is a huge factor. There are states that have gained their independence and their freedom. We've seen new countries born in our lifetime, East Timor, South Sudan. We saw the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, the breakup of the Iron Curtain after the fall of Berlin Wall near the end of the Cold War. You know, the rise again of China. These are big things that shape our world. Indigenous people here, are, you know, our people are no different to this. We are trying to have our voices heard in a world where everyone is trying to have their voices heard. There are fewer than 200 countries recognised in the world, and there are something around 10,000 individual peoples in the world. That gives you an idea of the contest for authority, the contest to be heard, the contest to be identified and acknowledged for who you are, whether that's Indigenous nations here, whether it's Indigenous peoples in other countries, whether it's the Welsh or the Scottish or the Irish, whether it's the Basque or the Catalan in Europe, whether it's the Quebecois, French-speaking Canadians, whoever it may be, you know, Shia, Sunni, Kurd, all of these people who are seeking to express themselves as a people in a world where there is a contest to be heard. And we're part of that. We are just part of that struggle. The challenges of a constitutional government in a world where people are contesting that space.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because you really put it in a global perspective where we kind of really localise it, and we forget all that as well. I mean,
yeah,
you know, amongst,
I mean,
it all.
Exactly. I mean, I lived in the world, you know. You see the rise of a group like the Islamic State, that comes out of a power relationship. The fall of Saddam Hussein, the fall of Sunni power in Iraq, the rise of Shia-dominated power, the Sunnis feeling disenfranchised and disenchanted, and then the rise of a radical, extremist, violent ideology that captures a lot of that disillusionment. We see that the world over. You know, this was the struggle of the IRA. This is the struggle of insurgent groups the world over. And we are a part of that, not that we are that violent insurgency, but the need to be heard. It is a global struggle. And I think we make a mistake when we imagine that somehow this is just unique to Australia and its little 200 plus years of history. There was history before that, there will be history after that. And the struggle throughout history is the struggle of peoples to hold on to who they are and to be able to express who they are in the face often of enormous oppression.
Well, I mean, on that note, I mean, it's very inspiring to even sort of think outside of our communities as well. But is there a message out there for all of those young aspiring journalists who want to make a change and support not only Indigenous voices, but all voices to be heard? Would you give any advice?
Yeah. Look, the best advice I would ever give to any journalist, Indigenous or not, is to be curious and to read and think constantly, to never stop thinking. Never accept anything that someone tells you. Don't accept because somebody in authority speaks that that is necessarily the final word on the subject. Don't accept what our own people tell us. Challenge. Think. Look at new ways of doing things. You know, my life has been about reading, has been about finding out about the world, has been about engaging with the world and different peoples in the world. And it's made me a better person and certainly made me a better journalist. But the key to it all is to have a thirst for knowledge and to be expansive, to think about your place in the world and to live in the world. I've lived outside of Australia for 17 years. I had the most amazing experiences and I will live outside Australia again. You know, I'm as fascinated by Chinese history and Russian politics and Middle East history and, you know, American history as anything else. And I think as journalists, we should not be constrained. We should be able to engage with the world and particularly as Indigenous people, think about our place in that world and reflect on what that world then tells you about our own struggles.
Well, Stan Grant, thank you so much for joining Living Black Radio. It's wonderful to be able to speak to you. Yeah, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.